This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is time to ask the doctors.
First COVID-19 booster shot to promise better protection against Omicron variants is now under review at the FDA.
Pfizer is asking the FDA now to authorize its improved COVID shots.
Now, these boosters promise better protection against Omicron variants.
Sound there, thanks to WCVB and WBZ-TV. Now, we've got these potential Omicron-specific boosters coming, but also lawsuits between the booster makers. The weather's getting cooler, though maybe it doesn't really feel like that today, and that will mean more time with others indoors, and of course, school. So, here with us to answer our questions and yours, Dr. Shira Durone, epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center and an associate professor at Tufts University School of Medicine, and Dr. Sabrina Asumu, infectious disease specialist at Boston Medical Center and an assistant professor at Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Durone, welcome back.
Great to be back.
And Dr. Asumu, great to have you back as well.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Dr. Durone, it has been a long 2.5 years at this point living with this pandemic, and it feels like we've had a lot of ups and downs. As I say that, I'm thinking about how right now the CDC has said that all of the counties in Massachusetts were low risk, but I also feel, Dr. Durone, like we're hearing people say, experts say, kind of just wait, it's about to get bad. So let's just start with, where are we right now?
Yeah, I mean, right now we are certainly not as low as we know that we can be, as we have been in the past. We appear to be slowly coming out of this latest wave, which was, you know, a wave that was definitely not as substantial as what we had seen in the winter, but was, you know, disappointing given how low we appeared to be getting. And that is really a function of these, you know, ever-changing, ever-mutating sub-variants of Omicron. So we're now in the BA5 period. And what comes next? We just don't know. Well, will there be a new variant? Will there be a weather effect? Or will we have enough immunity that we've built up from the Omicron, all of the Omicron infections, including a lot of BA5 infections, that we actually might weather this next cold period with little impact at all? It's just, you know, it just remains to be seen.
So, Dr. Sabrina Asumu, I want to figure out how to ask this follow-up question. Dr. Durone just talked about, you know, a little disappointing. We're not where we kind of hoped we would be. I also wonder, with something like the BA5 variant, which now makes up more than 90% of the cases in Massachusetts, being so infectious, and the fact that you can be reinfected even after having had it, even after having your vaccines, is it fair to be disappointed in ourselves? I mean, what else can we do, Dr. Asumu?
Yeah, no, it's definitely going to be, I'm also disappointed. You know, I'm always going to remember that November day when I heard that the initial vaccines were 95% effective. I really thought that we would be in a different place right now than we actually are. But, you know, what's happened is, you know, this virus has been a formidable foe. It's been changing. We've had waning immunity. But one critical thing, because I don't want people to feel kind of very discouraged, is that we really, really need to use a layered approach. Trying to rely on vaccines only, it's going to be really hard to get us out of this. I would love to see more focus on ventilation. You know, we're learning more. There's been money that's been allocated, especially for the schools, to improve ventilation. Can we use other layers? Can we improve our ventilation indoors? Can we provide more testing to people? And I'm actually very disappointed to hear the news that, you know, you can't, after Friday, you're not going to be able to order your free test to the Postal Service. Can we encourage people to use high quality masking indoors when cases are high? We just need to use a layered approach. And I think until we really internalize it and use all the different measures that we have been learning about over the past 2 years, it's going to be really hard to have a vaccine-only solution to this pandemic.
And just to pick up on something you said, Dr. Asumu, for our listeners, the Biden administration has announced that beginning Friday, it will no longer be shipping free at-home COVID-19 tests. They want to save the remaining amount that they have, they say, in case of some kind of major surge in the fall. And we are doing Ask the Doctors here on Radio Boston with Drs. Sabrina Asumu and Shira Durone. Dr. Durone, I'm going to play a little sound for you here from a school nurse, Marta Bosmer, who's at the Boston Green Academy. She was talking with us last week, and she put something into words that I think many of us have felt this summer. Here she is.
I think the summer, you have this like opportunity as a school worker to have the summer to kind of like reflect, slow down, and think about it. And I think I needed that more than I've ever needed that before.
This summer, I have needed this summer
so tremendously bad that, yeah, last year maybe the cases weren't as high, the numbers weren't as high at the end. I think we had more things together, but the weight of it was still present. It was still there because COVID is a lot for a school nurse. That was like another second job.
So, Dr. Durone, we're actually going to pick up on schools in a little bit. I want to stay focused on this needed it badly this summer, paired with, yeah, but we didn't get the break that we kind of thought we were going to get this summer. And Dr. Osumu saying there's so much work to do to still be using a better layered approach than we're doing now. How are you seeing burnout play out? You know, you're at Tufts Medical Center. Are we in a burnout stage right now?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, we can all feel the impact of shortages of workers in many sectors, but in healthcare in particular, amongst healthcare workers, we just haven't gotten a break. And, you know, right now what we're experiencing is not huge numbers of COVID in the hospital, definitely not. There's a lot of COVID out there, but not a lot of those are making it into the hospital. And we're almost never seeing anyone in the ICU with COVID pneumonia. But we are seeing short staffing, people who have left the workforce. We're still seeing a fair number of people get sick with COVID each day. Their infections are generally mild, but they're out for at least 5 days. And it is putting a huge strain on the system, which was seeing an increased acuity of patients even before the pandemic began. And there's a lot of factors that contribute to that increased acuity, but it was really the worst time for a pandemic to happen, to be honest with you.
So I want to jump into some listeners' questions now, Dr. Sabrina Osumu, and to remind our listeners, if you want to join our texting group, you can do so by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382 to get started. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. Jane in Scituate texted, "It seems like the intent behind waiting for the fall to launch a booster campaign will be the first of many annual vaccination campaigns similar to the flu vaccines. Can we expect the same for COVID vaccinations, or will we be continuing to see booster campaigns throughout the year?" So two pieces there, the CDC having waited on authorizing the second booster or additional boosters for people under 50, looking for these Omicron-specific ones, which have now been proposed for authorization. And then the idea that there's a time of year, Dr. Osumu, right, fall versus no. Nope, this is going to be kind of rolling thunder for us for years to come. What do you think?
Well, it's hard to predict what this virus is going to do. We've been trying to do this for the past, 2 years and have not always gotten it right. But one thing that we do know is that, in the fall or in the winter, when we tend to spend more time indoors in the Northeast, we tend to see more respiratory infections and, SARS-CoV-2 is a respiratory virus. So I would expect that, especially in the fall and winter, we'll probably see an increase in cases. And this will be the time when there will be campaigns to hopefully try to match the vaccine that we'll be offering with what we expect to see circulating in the community. Right now, I don't think we're at a point where this virus has settled into a seasonal pattern, As the nurse said previously in the little piece that you shared, we'd hope that the summer we're going to get a little more of a break than we actually had. And actually, anecdotally, personally, I felt like this summer I actually knew more people who had COVID than at any point during the pandemic. Hmm. So anyway, the point is it's a little hard to know what's going to happen, but I suspect that at least for the fall and winter, there'll probably be a vaccine campaign to try to vaccinate as many people as possible and trying to get ready for a heavy respiratory viral season.
So I do want to pick up another listener question here. This is from Cassie in Millis, Dr. Shira Durone. Cassie says, curious if they know how far off pediatric Omicron boosters are. Also, like everyone else, we want to know if we should wait until October to get the booster. So again, I want to be really clear. Right now, we are in a situation where people 50 and older qualify for an additional booster. There is conversation about a booster that would be more broadly available, ages either 12 or up or 18 and up. But those have not been authorized yet for use, and they would be Omicron specific. So sorry, I just wanted to clarify that, all of that for our listeners, Dr. Tyrone, because we're in such a moment of flux.
Yeah, it's a confusing time. It's a confusing time for the public, but also the experts. You know, so the question was, when will there be an Omicron booster for those under 12?
Yeah.
You know, it's really unclear, because the one for those over 12 is going through the process now without any clinical data. So it isn't like we're, like in the past, like we're waiting for some pediatric clinical trials to be performed or finished. This is really, you know, up to the FDA at this point. And one of the really difficult parts of this is they're really trying to fit it into the mold of the influenza vaccine campaign with an annual update and an annual vaccine campaign. It may not work, and that they've acknowledged that, because it isn't yet acting like influenza in many ways, and it may one day. You know, we may see that, and we have seen that COVID is worse in the U.S. South in the summers and worse in the U.S. North in the winters. So a fall campaign may not help the South, for example. And the people who have two vaccines and a booster are generally not experiencing waning of their protection against severe disease. The booster provides a brief protection against infection. And so, you know, where it might be expected to help is a brief protection against infection when infection is highest. And that may not be necessary to roll out across all age groups to achieve the goal, which may or may not be achieved in general.
Doctors Tyrone, Osumo, sit tight. I want to add another voice to the mix now. Joining us on the line, Dr. Davidson Hamer, infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, a professor of infectious diseases, and a member of the team at BU that makes its COVID policy decisions. And just for full transparency, I want to note that BU holds the broadcast license for WBUR. Dr. Hamer, welcome back to you.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you jump into this conversation, and I'm going to focus on you for just a couple of minutes because we are thinking a lot about return to school, and that, of course, includes colleges and universities, too. As you get ready to welcome back BU students, and I think move-in begins on Wednesday, where do you feel like we are right now with COVID, and do you feel ready?
Oh, it's a tough question. I mean, I think many universities, including Boston University, have really loosened their protocols relative to the spring and certainly a year ago. And, you know, given the evidence of still, you know, persistent circulation of the virus in the community and, you know, the potential for students to be, you know, bringing in different strains that we don't have in the Boston area, you know, I think it's, you know, it's a time that we need to be cautious. But that said, you know, most of the universities are mandating or have mandated vaccines and boosters. And so it's going to be a highly vaccinated population moving in. And then a number of precautions have been put in place to try and, you know, really minimize potential outbreaks.
Like what?
Well, it depends on the university. BU is having staggered move-in, so people have to register for a slot of time. This is what we did a year ago and actually 2 years ago. And so that there's going to be a lot less congestion and a lot less initial interaction. There is no testing on arrival. I have read, it looks like Harvard is encouraging everybody to have a rapid antigen test, at least anybody who's going to be on a campus dorm. But in contrast, MIT is not. So in a year ago, we had mandatory testing on arrival. So this is a big difference. And then the other big change is really the mask mandates. Pretty much they're gone. I mean, masks are recommended in certain locations. They're actually at BU, they are still required on like the BU shuttle, for example, so like public transportation. But in the classrooms and in other public places, it's really optional. If somebody feels they're at risk, then it's recommended they wear a mask. So it's really a very different world that we're entering right now, trying to learn how to live with COVID with a lot less intense restrictions.
I am mindful of having spoken a couple of minutes ago, and we'll bring them back again in a minute, Drs. Shira Doron and Dr. Sabrina Sumu, who talked about the fact that we weren't kind of where we were hoping to be this summer. You know, BU had a massive testing program in place for a long time and mask mandates in classrooms. Why not bring some of that back this fall, Dr. Hamer, given where we aren't?
That's a good question. I think that a lot of thought has gone into this and in developing a strategy and you know, aggressive testing for symptomatic individuals or people who've been exposed is available. So it will be possible to test it easily for those who have a close contact or those who experience symptoms. But the active surveillance that we did a year ago, or at least even through the spring, has been stopped. And I think this has been done really in collaboration and in discussion with other universities across the state. Whether this will work, time will tell. I am a little concerned just because of BA4 and 5 and their continued circulation. Many of the students may, at least some of the students may already have had these, so they should be immune to some recent variants. And then the vast majority will have been vaccinated and boosted, which will provide some degree of protection, especially against severe disease and hospitalization. So we'll see. My hope is that it goes well, but if it doesn't, then intensification of measures, including in classroom mask use, is one that I'm sort of on the fence about. We published a paper just a few months ago showing how well the combination of strategies, which included that as well as optimized ventilation systems and sort of active surveillance testing, that led to no evidence of transmission in classrooms last year. So these measures can work, and they can work very well. Question is, can we get by safely without many of them in place?
So we're speaking, we're having asked the doctors here on Radio Boston. You've just heard Dr. Davidson Hamer, who's an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, also part of the team at Boston University that makes its COVID policy decisions. We still have with us Dr. Shira Doron, who's an epidemiologist, and Dr. Sabrina Sumu, who's an infectious disease specialist. I want to bring the two of you back and say, we're a bit of a rare bird here in the number of college students that are about to descend on our greater Boston community. How are you thinking about that in your roles, either of you?
Well, when it comes to those layered mitigation strategies and selecting which ones to keep in place, it is not clear cut. Each one of them, we know, decreases transmission, and each one of them comes with its own set of downsides or negative impacts on things like, students' well-being and mental health. So, and socialization and things like that. So, it's not a question of science, really. It's almost a question of values. And you do have to ask yourself, for each one, not just what is the benefit in terms of reduction of transmission, but what is the net benefit overall in terms of health and well-being? And to me, the key strategy is actually for any organization to state its goal. What are you trying to achieve with mitigation? And then the answers will likely follow from there. Are you trying to achieve zero COVID? The answer is no, that's not possible. Are you trying to prevent outbreaks, or are you trying to prevent severe disease? And if you're trying to prevent severe disease, then of course the vaccine and booster mandates are really the cornerstone. And then other things could be implemented perhaps in the setting of outbreaks, but not necessarily at all times.
I want to build on that. I'll turn to you, Dr. Hamer and Dr. Sumu. Building on what Dr. Doron just said, as somebody who had a senior in high school in 2020 when all of this started to come down, to what extent is there also a goal now of harm reduction around the trauma of isolation, fear about COVID, separation, et cetera? Is that an active goal at BU, Dr. Hamer?
Yes, it is. I think that the evidence from across the country and even across the world of the negative impact on education and then the sort of the mental health, the stress of isolation that arose, especially in places that had prolonged sort of stay-at-home requirements. I think we want to try and avoid that. BU kept its classrooms open. Not the spring of 2020, but we reopened in the fall and tried to bring everybody back. Although we had a hybrid model at that point, with some learning remotely, some in class. But then we went to a full in-class back to normal. I think that model worked in the context of many, many different sort of components in place to try and reduce transmission. And as Dr. Durand said, at that point, we were really trying to reduce transmission to close to zero and try and prevent outbreaks. At this point in time, we know people are going to get sick. They're going to get COVID sporadically. We just really want to try and keep it under control so there's not a large-scale outbreak, but then allow students the opportunity to interact with each other, to interact with faculty and staff, and to avoid the potential isolation that could arise if we were to go back to those virtual learning environments.
So, Dr. Sabrina Asumo, I'm going to turn to you here. I'm going to play a little sound to help us open the aperture here. We've been talking about return to school in colleges and universities. Of course, many K through 12 students are getting ready to go back, this week, next week. I'm going to play sound from Marta Bosmer, the school nurse at Boston Green Academy, grades 6 through 12, who spoke with us on Radio Boston last week, talking about how she can't afford not to expect tough COVID this year.
When you're a school nurse, you have this interesting job of someone walks in the door and you have this 1 second situation where you can develop trust and you got to kind of be ready for anything. And I think I have to add COVID to that list because I have to be ready for it no matter what. It was so hard when it was here that I think it would be a shame for me to kind of put it aside. I think I have to take it seriously enough that it could be terrible, it could be nothing, but I have to keep it there kind of right at the forefront.
You're an infectious disease specialist. As we get ready for K through 12, what's the right objective for schools and school nurses? Where does the primary emphasis need to be, Dr. Asumu?
Well, if there's one thing we learned, one lesson we learned during the pandemic, is that it is so critical and important that we maintain in-person classes and in-person learning. And my perspective is that we use a layered approach, especially at times when cases in the community are higher. What we saw also in the spring of this year in Massachusetts, which was information that was published in a preprint from the Boston Public Health Commission and other researchers, was that when you use a layered approach and when you use masking at times when cases are high, it's also a way to keep in-person learning so that teachers are not sick. And I'm also talking not only from the science, but also some perspective of a parent. In our schools, teachers were being sick and there were classes that may not have had teachers if we didn't do anything and added an extra layer in addition to vaccination to be able to keep schools open. And, masks were recommended and re-implemented and we were able to keep the school open so that we finished the school year. So I think that the important goal is how do we keep in-person learning as long as possible? And my concern is that with these variants that are so transmissible, with the BA.5 that is so transmissible, as we've seen, a vaccination-only approach might not be successful. But, we'll see. We'll find out.
It makes me want to ask the three of you, and I'm going to encourage you to all sort of pile on this. Are we capable of having an undisrupted academic year this year? Undisrupted meaning not major disruptions. And I mean college and K through 12. I'd love to hear the three of you talk with each other about that question a little bit.
My answer is yes, we can do it. And I've been saying it from the beginning of this show. We have the layers. We know what they are. Let's use the science. We have local data, even data that Dr. Hamer published with his team from BU, that if you use vaccination and masking, that's a way to prevent in-class transmission. So my answer is yes, we can do it, but we have to use all our tools, including ventilation. And the soonest we do it, the better it will be for our kids so that we can keep in-person learning.
So that's Dr. Sumu's take. Drs. Durand, Hamer, how about you?
Well, some of the disruption is illness and some of the disruption is policy. You know, school closures in the past were a decision, and that's something that can't happen in Massachusetts because the Commissioner of Education, issued an order that a school that closes even for a day has to make up that day at the end of the year. So we won't lose in-person school days. Quarantines were a decision. If someone's exposed, they stay home for some number of days after exposure. That is no longer allowed in the state of Massachusetts. So we won't have disruption from that. And now being out of school for 5 days is policy. Of course, people should be out when they are sick. But we, you know, whether it's weeks, months, or years from now, at some point, we will likely adopt a stay home when sick model and people will be able to return sooner than 5 days. And as we move in that direction with each of those policies, we will see less of that disruption.
Dr. Hamer.
I'm cautiously optimistic that we are going to be able to get through the fall without, you know, major outbreaks or major disruptions, both for primary, secondary school and higher education. But I think that if we start to have rising prevalence of infection, and certainly in sort of student populations, then we may have to intensify measures. We may have to change, you know, go back to full mask mandates indoors, for example. And I think that one I chose first because I think that's one of the most important tools we have to try and control things. You know, superimposed, you know, layered on vaccine, sort of high level of vaccine coverage. You know, the ventilation part, at least at BU, has already been done. I mean, the buildings and ground people have gone through every building and tried to optimize the sort of filtration systems in all the buildings. And that was done a year ago, and I think they've done further work on that. So, you know, there's only so much you can do with that. But I think the hope is we can get by without masks in many settings and that we can, you know, have a sort of more of a normal school year.
So a couple more subjects I want to get to before we're done with this round of Ask the Doctors here on Radio Boston with Dr. Davidson Hamer, Dr. Sabrina Sumu, and Dr. Shira Durone. And the first is this lawsuit. So Moderna has filed a suit against Pfizer, both who are vaccine makers and both who have submitted Omicron-specific boosters for authorization for emergency use. The suit is over allegations of patent infringement. So Moderna is saying, hey, we had patents, Pfizer, you infringed upon them. Dr. Sumu, do you anticipate that this could disrupt production and supply? Or will this play out in the courts while booster approaches in the public health realm will remain the same?
It's a very good question, but I'll start my answer with saying this is not my area of expertise.
Fair enough.
I'm not a patent lawyer, but I'm hoping that this will not impact our immediate plans of boosters. Those seem to be sort of like in motion, and these things seem to often, you know, these cases seem to often take a long time to evolve and to get resolved. So I would not anticipate that it would have an immediate impact. But again, this is not my area of expertise, so I welcome others' opinions on this.
Doctors Durone or Hamer, any reason to believe differently than Dr. Sumu there?
Well, I can just add that, you know, some of the executives and scientists at Moderna are people that I know from over the years, and they're good people. And I have read that their intent is not to stop production of vaccine by Pfizer. Their intent is simply to seek monetary damages. And I would imagine that their ethics would certainly steer them towards anything that would not disrupt any production or supply.
So there is another thing that I want to bring up. We regular challenges of the start of a school year, COVID, and now also MPV. The MPV virus, which is broadly known as monkeypox, to think about. During our segment talking with school nurses last week, we also spoke with Heidi Winston, who's a nurse at Boston Teachers Union Pilot School. That's K through 8. And we had asked her if monkeypox is on the agenda at an upcoming planning meeting, and she said, nope, but I'm going to raise it.
I think we have to be prepared. You know, we need to know the facts. We need to know how it spreads, and it's skin to skin. So, you know, young children, they
play.
They touch each other. And my school has some very young children.
And then, of course, Dr. Hamer, you're on the opposite end of the spectrum with young adults. And there has been some concern in the early spread about sexual transmission, for example. It's not a sexually transmitted infection. Let me rephrase. I'm sorry. About close skin-to-skin contact through sexual activity, thus leading to spread of MPV. Is this really tight on your radar screen here at BU?
No, absolutely. In fact, I'm speaking in 20 minutes on a seminar about this.
Well, there you go.
A webinar, public health conversation about monkeypox. But you know, I think that universities are really concerned if this epidemic shifts to sort of sexually active college population and spreads as rapidly as it has done among men who have sex with men, bisexual men, and so forth. Then it you know, we could have a big problem in our hands. And so a lot of universities are already making efforts to, you know, basically have screening in place to educate their health personnel, but also to educate students about the disease, the risk, you know, risk factors for the disease and manifestations of it in case this were to happen. I mean, right now, it's really, you know, there have been very few cases, you know, there have been a few, like even daycare cases, according to colleagues at the CDC. So there's been a few outside of the high-risk populations. We need to continue to watch and monitor and see if more occur. But on the other hand, there's some evidence that the at least globally, that this epidemic may be starting to slow. And that may be a result of change in behaviors, but also the use of vaccine to try and control spread.
Well, this has been very helpful. Dr. Davidson Hamer is infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center and a professor of infectious disease, also a member of the team at BU that makes COVID policy decisions. Dr. Shira Durone, epidemiologist, Tufts Medical Center and Tufts University School of Medicine, and Dr. Sabrina Asumu, infectious disease specialist, Boston Medical Center, Boston University School of Medicine. I know your time is precious, and I appreciate it from all three of you that you spent some of it with us here on Radio Boston. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
What happens when a law that's meant to help victims hurts them? A WBUR investigation found that a privacy law designed to help victims of sexual assault and domestic abuse has done the opposite. It has shielded law enforcement departments and officers from scrutiny, thwarted researchers studying ways to reduce violence, and blocked victims from obtaining records that they may need for custody battles, restraining orders. In this week's From the Newsroom, WBUR senior reporter Allie Jarmanning joins us here in Studio 2 to talk about it. Thanks for joining us, Allie.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with the basic rundown, and let's begin with the law. What is it, and what was it supposed to do?
Sure. So the law was always intended to protect victims' privacy and to encourage them to report these crimes to police. And the reason we have this is because the former Weston police chief was saying that victims were afraid if they called the police, their address or their abuser's name would be on the local police log and end up in the paper, and then everyone would know what had happened. So lawmakers passed a bill that locked down all police records of these crimes. That means you can't get the reports. They don't show up on the public police logs. It is a complete black box.
Okay, and you say that no other state has a confidentiality law this broad. So what is broad? What's the distinction here?
Right. So many states have some kind of privacy protections for victims or witnesses, like take Vermont, for example. The police can redact the names of victims or witnesses on documents, but the reports of arrests are still public. Massachusetts went much further. They require police to completely withhold all records of domestic and sexual abuse.
Okay, and it occurs to me, I should ask you, as you began to dig into this, did you find any evidence that the intention of the law, which was to protect privacy but also increase reporting, actually happened? Do you know?
Yeah, well, we asked a lot of the advocates for that information, and nobody had any evidence they could point us to. So we did the work ourselves. We asked more than a dozen of the state's largest police departments for records of domestic violence calls before and after the law changed in 2014. We saw no meaningful change.
Okay, so from there, you did discover that the law was backfiring. How did you come across that?
Yeah, and it was really when I started talking to people who work in the field. So lawyers who work with domestic violence survivors on family court cases, advocates, victims, survivors themselves. And what I found was pretty disturbing. So, for example, victims are supposed to get ready access to these records. There's a carve out in the law for them. But when they would go to the police department, you know, the officer on duty would say, no, it's coded as domestic violence. We can't give it to you. And those officers are wrong, of course, but many people give up right there. And people need these records for things like restraining order hearings and custody battles. And there's those for who have no carve out in the law at all, like a mother I spoke to who knew her estranged husband had been accused of abusing other women. She wanted those reports to be able to show the judge in her custody case that she wasn't the only one, but because she wasn't the victim in those cases, she couldn't get the reports.
And you also found that police departments can or do use the law to shield information even about domestic violence homicide?
Yeah, we found more than a dozen homicides in recent years where police withheld records of previous reports of domestic violence. So these are cases where the victim has died, and before the homicide, police responded to domestic disturbances involving the victim and suspect. But without those documents, it's really hard to know whether police could have done more to prevent those murders.
So let's stay with law enforcement. Let's stay with police for a second. Allie, your reporting, you note that police regularly use the law to withhold information about officers who are accused of misconduct. How do they do this, and is this on purpose?
So they say that they're just following the law. So we found in our reporting that police departments are using it to withhold information about officers accused of domestic violence and sexual assault specifically. So more than 40 departments wouldn't provide us with internal affairs records of officers accused of rape, domestic violence, similar crimes. And these are internal affairs investigations. So these are when the department itself does an investigation after some kind of suspected wrongdoing by an officer. And the question of whether police departments are accurately using this law to withhold the files is actually the subject of some litigation. Both the Boston Globe and the AG's office are suing Boston police over the department's refusal to provide records about Dennis White, who, as I'm sure you remember, he's the former Boston police commissioner who was investigated by the department 20 years ago for domestic violence.
Okay, so 1974 original privacy law just applied to reports and arrests involving rape and sexual assault. When the legislature did this broadening in 2014, it applied to domestic violence, and supporters argued it was needed to encourage victims to report crimes to police. You've said, didn't find evidence that that happened, so were you able to speak to any of the supporters of broadening the law from then?
Yeah, I spoke to the original sponsor of the law 50 years ago, John Rotenberg. And he still believes that without these privacy protections, you know, victims are not going to come forward because rape is such a heinous crime. But he did say he thinks any law that's been on the books for that long deserves a review. And I also spoke to current state rep Alice Hanlon-Peisch. She's the one who sponsored the bill to include domestic violence in this privacy law. She said, though, she hadn't heard of any of the issues WBOR raised, she would be open to making some changes in the language.
All right, this is our From the Newsroom here on Radio Boston. We're speaking with WBOR senior reporter Allie Jarmanning on new reporting on unintended consequences of a privacy law. Allie, I'm going to have you stand by for a minute because I want to bring an additional voice in here. Jamie Sabino is the deputy director of advocacy for the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. Jamie spent 4 decades in family law and was consulted on the expansion of this law. Jamie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what we've been hearing from Allie's reporting, is that what you've been seeing, Jamie?
Absolutely. There have been, it's hard to say unintended, because a number of family law lawyers raised some of these issues in 2014 with the legislators, but were not heard. But there are two areas that we think this law is harming people. One is the direct victims' access. As Allie said, they have access, and they need these reports. They need them for custody hearings. They need them in a range of civil issues. They need them if they're immigrants and are applying under U and T visas to be able to stay. And they're routinely denied. I get calls maybe every 3, 4, 5 months from a lawyer, and the lawyer has gone down and has shown the law to the police officer and has been told no. And you have to work your way up to legal counsel. For those people who don't have lawyers or advocates, they just walk away. So we think that's harmful. But we're also concerned about domestic violence being away from the public in another way. As has been noted, this law came about in this omnibus bill, which was triggered by the Martel, Jerry Remy's son, the whole issue.
And so just for listeners, yeah. Son of former Red Sox player Jerry Remy, domestic violence and murder widely publicized in the press, et cetera.
And it was that publication in the press and the digging that press did showed a series of problems within the prosecutions, within police response. Now we can't do that. The police response is shielded. And it may be the commissioner of police or just may be the average guy who you want the world to know that this person is an abuser. And we think pulling down the blinds stops people who are investigating domestic violence homicides, who are doing safety audits on the whole system. Darkness doesn't help.
So I want to ask then, I'm speaking right this minute with Jamie Sabino, Deputy Director of Advocacy for the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. Was it a badly written law, or is it that you just can't do this? You can't provide this level of protection because no matter what, you're going to get these kinds of unintended consequences. Do you understand my question,
Jamie? Yes, and I don't think it's a badly written law. I had spoken to Rep. Peisch a few years before this when she was crafting it, and I did give her advice saying you should follow what is done around sexual assaults, and they very carefully crafted it. But it is doing what it's meant to do in some ways. But as I said, the harm of victims, and that is simply because the law is clear and police just don't follow it, particularly the guy at the desk. You never get dinged for something you do, that you didn't do. You only get dinged for something you do. So if they have any question, they're not going to give you the report. But it also has the bringing down the shutters on what's happening with police and domestic violence. And that could have been different. You could talk about amending this law. Maybe you don't want them in the local police logs, the funny things people read in the, Cambridge Chronicle or the Wellesley Townsman. But that doesn't mean that reporters or other people should be denied access.
So given, especially you mentioning reporters there, let's turn back to Ali Jarmanning, WBUR senior reporter. I really just want to ask you to pick up and riff on what you just heard from Jamie after I asked her, wait, is it the law, the way it was written, or execution?
Yeah, and one of the things Jamie and I talked a lot about was like the impact of keeping these things hidden and protecting privacy, with this complete withholding of records versus what is the harm that is caused by keeping these so secret that nobody can see what's going on here. Nobody can question what police are doing. Nobody can report on these kinds of issues. And it's a real balance, and Massachusetts decided to go to one end of the spectrum and just lock everything down. And I do think there's a question about whether that was too far and whether there is a way to kind of, thread the needle like other states have to protect victims and their information, but yet still provide the opportunity for scrutiny of how these cases are investigated and what police are doing when they're responding to these kind of calls.
So we're talking here about the Massachusetts privacy law that was meant to help victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, et cetera. But reporting from WBUR senior reporter Ali Jarmanning is showing a set of, well, I was going to say backfiring, but Jamie Sabino of Mass Law Reform Institute, you were like, no, there were people who knew this is how this was going to play out before the law was passed. One of the things that's playing in the back of my mind, Jamie, are the conversations around police reform in the Boston Police Department when the Police Reform Task Force by the City of Boston was put together. And there was discussion about levels or prevalence of domestic abuse among law enforcement officers, which, of course, came to light again, as Ali has mentioned, when Dennis White, a short-term commissioner of police in the city of Boston, old allegations were brought forward there. Is there a dimension here we should be paying attention to with that question, Jamie?
Absolutely. When groups like perhaps Jane Doe, the Sexual and Domestic Violence Council, do their yearly reports about domestic violence homicides, they have often in the past, prior to this law, had information about what was going on, and you could see what happened and what didn't happen and what might have happened. That avenue is closed. So people who are trying to look at the resources and the systems are blocked from it. They're blocked from it about their own police officers, but the whole public is blocked from it. And people still think that domestic violence is, oh, those people, a small group of people. They think domestic violence homicides, but that doesn't happen. And when I say, well, on average, every 15 or 16 days, there's a domestic violence homicide, they're shocked by that because they don't see the discussion as broadly as they used to in the papers. When it happens, you see the report, but you don't know what led up to it.
Ellie, you've this story first ran on Saturday night. It was in the print edition of the Boston Globe as well as here in WBUR on Sunday. Have you had reaction from police forces since the story came out? You've told us what the reactions were when you were attempting to get information.
Yeah, I you know, what I've heard, I haven't heard directly from any police departments about this, but what I heard over and over again is, you know, they're just following the law. You know, the law says we cannot provide these records or we could be fined $1,000 or receive up to a year in jail. And so they say that they feel very hamstrung by this and that there's no other option that they have. You know, as we were talking about before with police officers, I mean, we can't find out how police officers or departments are investigating their own officers accused of this kind of misconduct because of this law. And I've heard over and over again from different advocates that, like, that was not the intention of the law at all. And I think in this moment of police reform, when we are looking at, you know, transparency among departments, like, does that really make sense?
So, Jamie Sabino, just briefly, has Mass Law Reform Institute had any conversations with the police departments, for example, about changing training to make people at the front desk more responsive or more aware of how the law is supposed to work?
Well, it's actually on my to-do list. I have a big file at home about police reports, and the officers say they're just following the law, but they're not following it when it comes to victims. And we've been talking about doing a small roll call training to see if the Mass police chiefs will send that out. But it's still hard. There was a quote from the Boston Police Department saying, oh, we know this. We give victims records. They don't. I have at least two instances in the past 3 or 4 years where we had to go to corporate counsel to get the victim the ability to get the report.
And last one over to you. Back to you, Allie Germanning. You're going to be on Morning Edition tomorrow morning to talk more about this story. Can we have a little bit of a sneak preview?
If you want the sneak preview, you can read the print story that's online right now.
WBUR.org.
But, you know, we are really going to talk to the most important issue, which is the victims in these cases, the victim survivors. I speak to three women who have very different stories, but all with the same result. They had an incredibly hard time getting their own reports, or they couldn't get them at all because of different issues with this law. Some victims who do have a carve-out in the law, some who there is no carve-out for, but they really needed these reports for their own healing and for their own cases.
All right, from the newsroom, that is WBUR senior reporter Allie Germanning, and also with us Massachusetts Law Reform Institute's Deputy Director of Advocacy, Jamie Sabino. Thanks to both of you for being here in Studio 2.
Thank you for raising this important issue, and thank you to Allie for a great job.
Oh, thank you, Jamie. Thanks, Tiziana.
Thanks, Allie. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez and Rob Lane. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director, with help today from Caleb Green. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for starting your week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.